Now, let me introduce our next speaker, Dr. Roy Fredericks. He's the manager of estate administration and personal injury liens in the Oregon Department of Human Services. He's a 22-year veteran of the department, and he helped craft Oregon's nationally recognized estate recovery program. The American Bar Association recognized this summer as one of the two top programs in the country. During his career, he's had a number of important responsibilities, including overseeing Medicaid eligibility at the county level and managing a client care monitoring unit where he was responsible for inspection and quality assurance for 60 Medicaid, Medicare nursing homes and 120 residential care facilities. And I want to publicly thank him for taking time to learn about Wisconsin's estate recovery program so that he could focus today on those things that might be of most interest to Wisconsin policymakers. Now, Mr. Fredericks tells me that he had three children later in life, and he said, whoever partakes in fatherhood in their 40s deserves whatever they get. He also tells me he's an insatiable collector. He has been successful in collecting 8,000 jazz albums, but that's only leads to one impediment. They're slowly taking over his basement. So his topic today is successes and impediments, but of Oregon's experience with asset transfers and estate recovery. Mr. Roy Fredericks.
Thank you, Karen. One clarification, I don't have an earned doctorate, it's just Mr. I have a master's degree. It's really a pleasure to be here in the state of Wisconsin and talk a little bit about the estate recovery program in Oregon. I want to just digress a little bit from my notes and just comment that I'm very interested in what Mark mentioned about the innovations in long-term care that are on the horizon. Can everyone hear me all right?
Everyone hearing okay?
Okay. Because I, as Karen mentioned, I started out many years ago. Actually, I started out in child welfare as a protective services worker, did that for several years, then moved on working with senior and disabled, took over management of a county Medicaid program, and then managed a surveyor group of nurses that inspected nursing facilities and residential care facilities. So I guess I've seen all of the aspects of social services administration, if you will, and how I ended up managing an estate administration program. I'm not quite sure, but I ended up doing it. I guess I'd like to begin by saying or explaining why there is an estate recovery component to Medicaid. And primarily there's an estate recovery component because it's federally mandated. And under federal law, all states that participate in Medicaid must, at a minimum, recover the cost of long-term care services that are provided to clients. And then they have, depending on what sort of waiver programs they have in place, they may elect to recover community-based waivered services. That could be adult foster care, assisted living, in-home services, whatever the waiver program specifies. And also the cost of prescription medications for community-based waivered clients. So that's basically why it happens. The federal government tells us we need to do it. What are the current Medicaid eligibility criteria? Well, in general, Medicaid resource limits $2,000. So if someone's interested in getting Medicaid coverage, they have to spend down to $2,000. The client's home generally is treated as an exempt resource. And there are guidelines that the federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid prescribe for how to treat transfers of assets and how to basically implement the program. So there's general guidelines out there, but every state does it slightly differently, depending on some of the state laws that may impact the Medicaid program. And one question that comes up repeatedly is, why should Medicaid eligibility have anything to do with state recovery? And the fact is that they're basically two sides of the same coin. In other words, what is allowable under Medicaid eligibility criteria as an acceptable transfer of an asset, then at the time of the client's death, that asset is no longer available upon which the state might make a recovery. So they really are two sides to the same coin. Now, these examples I'm going to mention are some of the most common asset transfers between spouses, and this is based on Oregon's experience, and I'm sure Wisconsin's probably somewhat different, but there may be some similarities, probably are some similarities, especially with respect to interspousal transfers. For example, in Oregon and under federal law, a Medicaid recipient may transfer to a spouse their ownership interest in the family home. This can be while they're on Medicaid receiving services. Once that transfer is complete, since the client will not have an ownership interest in the home at the time of their death, there can be no estate recovery claim. It's legal, simple, happens all the time. Court-ordered transfers is another example that is utilized, especially in Oregon, where a court order is used to transfer assets to the community spouse, quite often in the neighborhood in Oregon of $180,000 or more. And once again, since the Medicaid recipient at the time of their death will not have an ownership interest in those assets, that precludes any Medicaid estate recovery. Annuities. The Medicaid applicant can transfer most of their assets to their spouse, and the spouse can then purchase annuities that are not counted in determining Medicaid eligibility. This is a common technique that's used to qualify people for Medicaid. And then there's the penalty or look-back period. One of the common Medicaid planning devices is basically to give your assets away, or at least most of your assets away, and then wait the look-back period for Medicaid eligibility. Under the old law, it was 36 months. That just changed under the Deficit Reduction Act, signed by President Bush last week. And I think now it's going to be a five-year look-back period. And I suspect the Medicaid eligibility state agency people are going to be looking at the law and sort of the impact that's going to have on eligibility as well as estate recovery. What often happens is, I mentioned earlier the 2,000 resource limit, but it's really half of what your countable assets are, because you give them away, half of what you give away. You go into a long-term care facility, you wait the 36 months if you're in there that long, making your payment privately, and then by the time the penalty period has been exhausted, you qualify for Medicaid. Now, there's a wrinkle in the new law which says that the disqualification period begins not at the time of transfer but at the time of application. So that's a bit of a change, but I'm sure the elder law practitioners are probably looking at the law very carefully to see, you know, how they can approach that and still allow people to become Medicaid eligibility. One of the things I heard at a symposium I went to just last week with some of the elder law practitioners in Oregon is, the comment, well, we'll just have somebody give the money away initially and then immediately apply for Medicaid, start that clock ticking so that by the time the 5 years rolls around, if they need Medicaid, they're going to be eligible. Now, I don't know if, you know, I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of strategizing going on. But I think that's one option that probably they're going to be looking at. The Deficit Reduction Act also mentions about Medicaid eligibility not being, you wouldn't qualify if you had an equity interest in a home of $500,000. But once again, how many people have an equity interest in their home of $500,000? Not very many. So is it really a substantive change to eliminating people that wouldn't otherwise qualify for Medicaid? Probably not at this stage. I did a little bit of comparison between Oregon and Wisconsin's programs with respect to estate recovery. I also want to thank Kathy Emerton, the Wisconsin State Recovery Manager. I was on the phone with her several times trying to get information on Wisconsin's program, and she sent me a number of materials that were very helpful. And I want to give my thanks to her. In fiscal year 2003, Oregon recovered $20 million, actually a little more than that, which was 2.2% of the Medicaid long-term care expenditures. And during that same period, Wisconsin collected $17.6 million, which was 0.8% of its Medicaid long-term care expenditures. And Oregon recovers approximately $14 for every dollar spent on staff salaries and benefits. So there is a cost benefit there. And I guess the question might be, well, why should you care about that? Well, in an era of diminishing resources, the millions of dollars that the state recovery program can bring in can help maintain programs that would otherwise be eliminated that would serve the vulnerable population of seniors and disabled clients. So it is, federally mandated, but it also, in its own way, is a program that helps people because it brings money in to sustain programs that otherwise might not survive. I want to talk just a moment about best practices that both Oregon and Wisconsin have implemented on the estate recovery side. Oregon and Wisconsin does an excellent job of statewide training on estate recovery, and this is really critical because the eligibility workers and case managers that are implementing the program have to be knowledgeable about the program and be able to answer questions that applicants and family members may have so that they'll understand the caveat that there is a component of estate recovery if you receive Medicaid assistance. In my mind, no Medicaid recipient should ever be surprised that there will be an estate recovery component at the time of their death, or if they have a surviving spouse, at the time of their surviving spouse's death. That should be, that shouldn't be a surprise. That should be out there for everybody to know. I think it's critical. To try to get that message across, both Oregon and Wisconsin train all of the new Medicaid eligibility workers on the estate recovery program. Both states review all the probates filed in the state, and that's basically an effort to identify deceased Medicaid recipients that received public assistance so that a claim can be made in their estate for that, the amount of public assistance that's been provided. Okay. In both states, the state has been given priority creditor status by statutory changes. And, of course, the advantage to that is there's no reason why the state should be at the same level as a general creditor when public assistance, public monies have been utilized to help somebody. The state should be given a priority creditor status, and in both states they have been. There's also a requirement that the state in both Wisconsin and Oregon be notified, mandatory notification, of whenever a probate is filed or a transfer by affidavit in the state of Wisconsin. Both states can nominate a personal representative to probate an estate, depending on the circumstances. Sometimes you have family members that don't want to do anything, or there are no family members. So sometimes the state has to step into the shoes of the deceased recipient and nominate a private attorney under contract with the state to probate the estate so that there will be a forum upon which to present a claim. And I think one of the critical elements that both the state of Oregon and the state of Wisconsin utilize is the development of a fairly exhaustive brochure that's handed out at the time anyone comes into the social services offices interested in applying for Medicaid. The brochure talks about the estate recovery program and explains the components and what's recoverable, what isn't. And once again, I think that's critical, that family members that are assisting Medicaid clients and Medicaid clients themselves have a knowledge of the program. Nobody should be surprised by the program. Now, sometimes family members are surprised. Because they're mother or father didn't mention that they were receiving assistance. And unfortunately, under the Medicaid confidentiality rules, if a family member had contacted us and had actually inquired and said, is mom or dad receiving Medicaid, we couldn't even disclose to them without the client's written permission whether or not their mother or father were actually receiving Medicaid. So sometimes this does come as a shock to family members. There are some additional what I would call best practices that Oregon's implemented. And by best practices, what I mean by that is best practices for recovery of money, okay, state recovery. It does not necessarily mean that it's the best practice in every state of the union, okay? I want to make that clear. What might work in Oregon may not be the best practice for the state of Wisconsin, because you've got, you have the best sense of what your constituents would accept and think is reasonable and appropriate. One of the things we've done, and this is allowable under federal law, is we've expanded the definition of a state for estate recovery purposes to include client survivorship interests in property where the property is vested with right of survivorship, life estate interests, living trusts, and remainder interests in client-created annuities. Okay? And those areas of recovery bring in approximately 20 to 25% of that $20 million a year that we get. So it's a fair chunk of change. One of the other things that we do in Oregon is that we recover from the estate of the surviving spouse. And I understand in Wisconsin there's been a couple court decisions that at the present time are holding that precludes that, although if you look at the federal law, it certainly allows that. And we estimate that 10 to 15% of our total recoveries come from being able to present a claim in the estate of the surviving spouse. Now, I want to make it clear that estate recovery, the estate recovery program, is not like a collection agency. We're not a collection agency in the sense that we, you know, just send out a bill and expect to get paid. One of the things that distinguishes an estate recovery program is that there are a number of exemptions from estate recovery. If there's a disabled child, generally, estate recovery is waived. If there's a blind child, it's waived. If there's a minor child, child under age 21, at the time the claim is asserted, generally the claim is waived. If there's a surviving spouse, the recovery is deferred until the death of that surviving spouse. And beyond that, there's also a hardship waiver program. Every state has to have a hardship waiver program, which allows people to petition the state to say, if you go forward in asserting this claim to recover your funds, it's going to cause me personal damage. It's going to create a significant hardship on me. And every state has developed their own specific hardship waiver criteria. So I want to make it clear that there's a lot of elements at play here that impact the ability for the state to recover funds. And ordinarily review of hardship waivers, I think at least the state perspective in Oregon is that we always want to err in trying to give the benefit of the doubt to the family members. One other practice that we've implemented in Oregon is that if the family wants to retain the home, we'll work with that family to allow it to happen. Okay? We'll set up basically an accounts receivable and work with establishing installment payments so they can pay off the public assistance debt over time if they're serious about keeping that home in the property. We don't want to disadvantage a family if we can avoid it. And I think it's critical that from an estate recovery perspective that you worked with the family members and that the public has a perception that you're willing to work with them. One other thing that is sort of unique in Oregon is that we have sort of an electronic eligibility system And what happens is when a client dies, we're notified by the local field unit within 10 working days. And that allows us, when we get that notification, to take some immediate actions to recover bank funds and personal incidental funds that may be held by providers. And by taking actions soon after the client has passed away, we're able to recover funds that might otherwise be used for other purposes and may be in violation of the hierarchy of claims within the state. So that's a critical element. And I mentioned in here, in state recovery, time is money. The sooner you know about the death of somebody, the sooner you can take an action, you can notify people of the pending claim and start working with family members to try to address the issues. The state has also implemented a request for notice where with the county clerk, where we're notified whenever a piece of client-owned property is transferred or encumbered. And often this is very helpful because the local eligibility unit will not be aware of a transfer. We'll know about it first and notify them so they can follow up with the family or the client. And also it identifies situations where there may be financial exploitation of the client going on, where you have a power of attorney being used to transfer a home into the name of some other person. Could be a neighbor, could be a friend, sometimes a family member. But that's very critical in identifying elder abuse, financial exploitation. We also have the ability to subpoena bank records or other legal documents when there's evidence or a suggestion of evidence of Medicaid fraud. And I think that's critical. So to sum up, what is good estate recovery policy? Well, there is no one-size-fits-all that applies to every state. The policymakers, the legislators, the state agency people, all working together, you know, in concert with their constituents and their and the public, has the best knowledge of what works for your state. These are just some options, but know what might work in Oregon may not work in Wisconsin. In my mind, the groundstone for good public policy is that it must be fair, equitable, and responsible to the sensibilities of the citizens. And it's just how you balance those interests that makes a difference and how it's perceived. And I'd like to basically welcome any questions for the next 5 minutes.
Any questions for Mr. Fredericks?
Hi.
Hi.
The federal government did just change some of the eligibility rules for this divestment. I mean, how is that going to affect your program? How do you, maybe you can explain the group nationwide.
Well, theoretically, the changes, and I haven't looked at all of them because it's a document about this thick, but theoretically it's supposed to prevent the divestiture of assets and minimize that happening so that theoretically there would be more assets available at the time the person came on Medicaid upon which perhaps you could make a claim against at a later date. Now, whether there's going to be a direct correlation between some of those changes and actually being able to recover those assets, I think it's too soon to tell. Because once again, the elder law communities and the estate planners are going to be looking at those changes very closely to see where there's some wiggle room and where there's some opportunities to still divest assets and avoid estate recovery. So I guess in answer to your question, we're still waiting to see how that plays out. I'm sure the state agency people, if there's some in the room here that are looking at eligibility, some of the eligibility changes are going to be poring over that document for the next few weeks. And probably going to be making some statutory changes as a consequence. But whether or not it's going to have a significant impact on state recovery, I think at this stage it's too soon to tell.
I'd like to continue on that topic because I think that there's probably some serious unintended consequences because, you know, I'm sort of guessing the people that are surprised are the people that didn't plan ahead. And clean out the accounts before the state could, you know, recover some of this money. Have you looked, and has anybody thought about the unintended consequences of people divesting even sooner? Because I think that's what's going to happen. When we have a mindset now that health care is a right and not an obligation of a family or people, I just think that the mentality is now let's make sure that we've got all the assets cleaned out so that the government is going to take care of mom and dad or whatever for long-term care. And when you back it up 5 years and people start, you know, divesting sooner, I just wonder if there's not going to be some more problems and people wind up in on assistance even sooner than what this was proposing. Has anybody looked at that at all?
Well, once again, I think it's too soon to tell, but I think that's, you know, what you're suggesting is a possibility. Although it's already been happening, you know, the 36-month look-back period is already being utilized, so they'll look at it instead for 60 months. You know, I think that's a possibility. I think it's too soon to tell how it's going to play out.
When people divest 5 years ahead of time, 60 months, I mean, that's a long time for people to have no assets. I mean, you see what goes on in 36.
Sure, and I think the attitude why it was changed at the federal level was the thought that because it was 5 years, it would be less likely that people would divest their assets because they wouldn't be thinking that far ahead that they would need long-term care. Now, that may, in fact, not be the case. Some people may, in fact, be approaching it and will just divest everything at the five-year mark and start, you know, watching the calendar so that when they reach that point in time, they'll be able to be approved for Medicaid. But once again, that means then when they give away those assets, they're going to have to go in immediately to the county office and say, I want to apply for Medicaid, because the disqualification period begins from the time you give the assets away. Okay.
Representative Sherman, and then Heidi will come up here.
Thank you. I quit doing divestment for my law clients in the early 90s because I was bothered by the morality of it. But when I do talk to people, I always emphasize what's in that early slide, and that is that even at age 85, we're still only talking about 40% of the population. There is never a majority of the population in long-term care. And if you look at everybody over 65, it's really only about 5-6%. And most of the people over die between 65 and 85. So that for most people, to give up control of your property, and I always tell my clients, if you give it away, it's no longer yours. Your kid has a car accident. Your kid dies, leaving a widow who's not related to you or a widower. You've given up control of your property. To give up control of your property for certain in exchange for a relatively low risk that you're going to be in long-term care and on Medicaid isn't necessarily a very wise decision.
That's an excellent point.
And, you know, maybe a little bit we need to do some public education on that, because there are clearly people advertising the ARP magazine. I'm an ARP member. People advertising the ARP magazine, people holding quote-unquote seminars, who make a huge living out of frightening old people to death.
Absolutely.
You know, about probate, about long-term care and like that, and we ought to be countering that with things like that statistic in that early slide.
Okay, we'll have one quick question here.
How was the transition?
Oh, just a second. We got to wait for the mic. Okay. There we go. I need a quick answer.
How long ago did Oregon move to these new, asset recovery mechanisms, and how was the transition?
We implemented the expanded definition of estate back in 1995, so we've been doing it for about 11 years now, and with relative success. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.